Hello, and welcome to your docking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill Redway, and this is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday, the 21st of March, 2020. I do hope you're well and keeping safe in these very difficult times. Before we get going, Rob would like to say a few words regarding our plans for the weeks and months ahead.
Hello, and thanks to Bill for allowing me time in his programme this week to provide you with a report on what we at The Talking Newspaper are planning to do during the current situation. Now, we sat down and looked at what's happening and where we might have to change the way we operate. And we defined two demands which we want to meet. The first demand is to keep our programmes going and to make sure that we do everything to reach each and every listener. Unfortunately, many talking newspapers across the United Kingdom are having to close down altogether, but we are not going to do that. We will carry on reaching you. The second demand is to look after our volunteers and protect them from any additional risk to their health. After all, many of us are over 70, and some, including me, are way beyond that magic number. Now, in a moment, I'm going to come back to how we're going to get our weekly and quarterly programmes to you so that you can keep up with the local news and also enjoy some of your regular favourites, including our usual suggestions for programmes on national radio that you might find of interest in the following days. But first, let me go back to the need to protect our volunteers and the way it also connects to the need to protect you. We usually make our programmes by having four readers come into the studio to record the news stories, as well as other guests who come in to be interviewed or take part in a discussion. Now, obviously, we can't take the risk of having more than one person in the same small room at once. It's just too dangerous at the moment. Also, we're concerned that however much we and you may clean and wipe the surfaces of the memory sticks and wallets, we cannot be absolutely sure that we can avoid any risk of an infection being sent to you or picked up by a volunteer. So we have to stop sending out the usual memory sticks in the wallets. In fact, the one you've received this week is the last one you'll get until the situation is over. And what we've done is come to an agreement with our local community radio station. It's called Radio Verulam. And we've been working with them for some years already, so we know them, and we've been providing our news stories and other items and features in a programme that's broadcast each week to a wider general audience around the city and district. Now, from next week onwards, we're going to be changing the way that programme is put together, so that it's aimed specifically at you, our talking newspaper listeners, as well as at the general public who listen to Radio Verulam each week. Now, this is where it gets a little bit more complicated for a moment, because you'll need to know how to tune into Radio Verulam. I know that some of you already do, but I also know that it's not easy for anyone with a serious sight loss to retune their radio. It's fiddly, and you need ideally to be able to see the dial or the buttons clearly. We also know that some of our listeners do not actually own a radio, because you can get your radio programmes through the television or in some other way. But once we know how many and which of our listeners are without a radio, we'll find a way to get one to you, pre-tuned to Radio Verulam. But for those who do have a radio, here's what to do if you can adjust the tuning on your radio to find Radio Verulam, which is at the magic number 92.6 FM. Now, just to clarify for you, BBC Radio 4 is on a wavelength between 92 and 95 FM. BBC Radio 2 is between 88 and 91 FM. BBC Radio 3 is on 91 to 93 FM. Now, exactly at which point within those ranges they are on your radio depends where you are. Now, on my radio, and I just tried it, Radio Verulam is a very short distance on the dial from Radio 4 in one direction and Radio 2 in the other. So really 92.6, which is the wavelength that we're looking for Radio Verulam, it's about halfway between Radio 2 and Radio 4. Now, if that all sounds like gobbledygook, we want you to hold on to this memory stick and not send it back in the post until we can all breathe freely again when the virus has been defeated. Now, if you have trouble finding Radio Verulam 92.6 FM, perhaps you can ask a family member or a friend or carer or neighbour when they next make contact or visit. If they can listen to this message with you, they can help you to find Radio Verulam. Now, if you don't have a radio that can be tuned in, or if you're not able to get help to tune in to Radio Verulam on 92.6 FM, then please make contact with us as soon as you can by using one of the telephone numbers that I'll give you very shortly. Perhaps during the week, when somebody visits, you can get them to test to help and find where is Radio Verulam at 92.6 FM. But of course, what you also need to know is what times and on which days of the week we'll be broadcasting our programme. So once again, keep this memory stick, don't send it back to us, and then you can listen again at any time to remind yourself of these details. We'll broadcast to you each Wednesday evening from just after 7 o'clock in the evening. That's Wednesday evening. It's just after the National News and Sport Bulletin, which runs on Radio Verulam at 7 o'clock. So it's just after that. We'll also broadcast to you the same programme on Sunday morning from just after 8 o'clock. Again, that's just after the National News and Sport Bulletin at 8 a.m. So we're trying to provide for those who wake up early, like me, or those who are still going in the evening, also like me. Now, at the moment, our programme will begin with a message from me, and then I'll hand over to the host of a short piece that looks at the local environment and sustainability. After that, we'll have some of the local news stories, and other items will follow. I'll guide you through the programme on the broadcast with special links in between, so you know where we are. Now, as we move forward over the next weeks, we may well find, and I have every expectation of this, that we've actually got more time to broadcast, and we may also be able to broadcast at additional times during the week. But as I'm sure you'll understand, we'll be moving forward one step at a time. Now, I'll also be sending a letter to each listener explaining all of this again, so that you can either read it yourself or have someone help you with the content. Let me just say that for those who have access to the internet or to a mobile phone or some other device, we'll continue to put our weekly and quarterly programmes onto our website. That is, of course, www.sadtn.org.uk, and you find the programmes on the Listen Online page. We'll also continue to upload the programmes each week to the British Wireless Fund for the Blind app, Talking Newspaper. Now, this is something you can get on a mobile phone. And again, if you have a mobile phone, you want to know how to get that, give us a ring, ask us, and we'll help you. We're also looking at other ways that we can find perhaps to help you listen to our programmes, but that's more for the future, perhaps for the next weeks. Of course, one of the things we all recognise is that one of the worst things we can feel is to be left out, isolated, separated from other people. So do remember that many of our volunteers, including me, are also having to isolate themselves, either because of their age or their health. So our volunteers are stepping forward to offer a new service for our listeners. And our aim, quite simply, is to have each volunteer make contact with one or more listener by telephone on a regular basis. The aim is to make sure that every listener has someone who is keeping in touch with them regularly. Now, let me emphasise, they will not come to visit you because that might put you and them at risk, but they will reach you by telephone. We're asking each of them to start the conversation by saying who they are, giving you their name, and the fact that they're from the Talking Newspaper. They will not know your home address. I'm sure you understand this will take a little time to sort out, maybe a week or two, but we already have quite a large number of volunteers ready to help, and now we need to match them to individual listeners. Now, if you feel that because you've got plenty of other contacts and you don't want to be bothered by another one, please let us know, because then we won't put you on the list. Well, there's plenty to think about, but what's really good is that our local community radio station, Radio Verulam 92.6 FM, is absolutely committed to working with us. They see this as a great way in which they can help the community at large and in many ways. And I think it will be very interesting to see how this develops. But of course, our volunteers want to do all they can to support you. That's why they're coming forward and saying, yes, they will do the telephone support that we're talking about. Right, now I said there were some telephone numbers of our special HIT team that are ready to help you settle into this new situation and to answer any questions you may have at this stage. Now, above all, don't give in if something's complicated at the first, because we will find a solution so that every single listener is receiving our programs every week as you have done for however many years. You're going to make it work. You've got three listener representatives you can always reach at any time. By all means, contact them first. But as they'll probably need to pass your message on to us, you may as well go directly to one of the following three volunteers. This is our great team. Sue Fennell can be reached on 01727 765 852. 01727 765 852. Linda Randall can be reached on 01582 832 275. 01582 832 275. And Robin Cristoforo can be reached on 01727 866 725. 01727 866 725. My apologies, this has been such a long message, and my apologies to Bill for taking so much time out of his programme, but these are extraordinary days. All I can say is that we'll do our best to help you to get through these days, and in the meantime, keep washing your hands, keep safely indoors, and keep listening to the radio.
Well, the programme this week is produced largely from home, mine and others, so it may have a certain homemade quality about it. At any rate, we do have a selection of news stories from the Hearts Advertiser, as usual, followed by our suggestions for radio programmes that might be of interest over the next 7 days. Later, there are a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine. First, about the remarkable scientist and inventor of the Gaia theory, James Lovelock, and another on the world's largest printing press, which just happens to be in Broxbourne. By the way, the music this week is by the remarkable AKA Trio, comprising Antonio Forcioni on guitar, Sekou Keita on the African Kora, and Adriano Adewale on percussion. The track I'm playing is called Joy, from the album of the same name, and goodness me, joy is something we can all do with these days. They've kindly given their permission for us to use their music on Talking Newspapers. As usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. We start with the news, and our readers today are Gilly, Ian, Jenny and Bob. Today's first story is read by Bob.
Stick one in to save pubs. St Albans pubs were hit with a 90% drop in revenues within 24 hours of Boris Johnson advising people not to go to pubs. But landlords are not going down without a fight, and a bold campaign has been launched to ensure St Albans' beloved pubs weather the coronavirus storm. Campaign group Save St Albans Pubs, which has been fighting against high business rates for the past few years, is promoting the Stick One In initiative to keep them afloat. The scheme was the brainchild of District Councillor Danny Clare, and calls on pub supporters to phone their local and buy a £20 voucher for a round of drinks in the summer. The campaign's vice chair, Mandy McNeil, said, "We're asking you, our community, to do everything you can do to support your local at this time. Call up your local, order a takeaway and pick it up, or let them deliver it to you. Stick one in so that when this is over in the summer and the sun is shining, you can go out to your favourite local pub. They will still be there and there will be a drink with your name on it." Christo Tafali, landlord of Ye Olde Fighting Cock, said, "We have some of the most historic pubs in the country, and it would break our hearts to have to close them. If people jump on this campaign, it could make all the difference to us." Campaign Chairman Sean Hughes added, "The government must still go further to help our pubs. 30% of pubs in St Albans have a rateable value of over 51k, so they will not get the 25k grant. We must help these pubs. We demand the grant be extended to all pubs. We also need a 75% guarantee on staff wages so that we can close if ordered to. We also need to see these grants paid into the bank accounts of companies under the 51k immediately, as pubs have had their income slashed by 80% plus." And there's a picture of some campaign group members standing outside the Boot in St Albans.
Hello, I'm Jenny. Homeless services take action against coronavirus crisis. A crucial homeless service in St Albans is taking action to ensure minimal disruption is caused by coronavirus. Open Door Night Shelter on Brickett Road provides temporary overnight accommodation for people who are roofless, homeless, with nowhere such as a friend's sofa to stay. It also has a kitchen, which provides food throughout the day. Hightown Housing Management have confirmed that none of the residents there have shown any symptoms of coronavirus. They are asking staff and residents to wash their hands regularly and to use hand sanitizer. They say they are monitoring the situation and will ensure they follow the latest Government and Public Health England guidance. A spokesperson from Open Door said, "We have also reviewed our business continuity plan so we would be able to deliver the best possible service in the circumstances. If a resident did show symptoms and needed to self-isolate, they have their own bedroom and bathroom, and we would be able to bring food to them so they wouldn't need to enter the kitchen or communal area. Our outreach workers offer a vital service, and they are continuing to engage with homeless people who are sleeping rough. However, they are keeping a safe distance and ensuring they're not in confined spaces with anyone who shows symptoms. If someone did show symptoms, we would work alongside the NHS and council to provide the best support and advice possible." Open Door, which is run by Hightown Housing Association, also offers laundry facilities, support with CV writing and job applications, help with housing inquiries, mental health counselling and more. Centre 33, an open street cafe for homeless and vulnerable people providing breakfast and an evening meal, has had to close. A note went on the door on Tuesday, March 17th, saying the centre is shut. Their Facebook page said, "Centre 33 is closed with immediate effect for in-house meals. We are currently liaising with the council and other local agencies who support the homeless to ensure that we can support them going forward. Further details will be communicated shortly." And there's a picture of the Open Door Night Shelter on Brickett Road.
Hello, this is Ian reading from home with my apologies for my hay feverful voice. The headline reads, "An escalation of contingency measures as the war against coronavirus outbreak continues. Events across the district are being cancelled as the threat of a coronavirus outbreak begins to take effect. Oaklands College in St Albans cancelled its annual lambing weekend as a precaution to prevent the spread of the disease. The community event, which was due to take place last weekend on the Hatfield Road campus, enables agricultural students to gain experience delivering newborn lambs, while thousands of visitors take part in activities and enjoy refreshments. The college decided to cancel the event due to the ongoing coronavirus situation, which has now been declared a global pandemic by the World Health Organization. A statement from the college said, "In light of the evolving situation, we have very reluctantly decided to cancel our annual lambing weekend. We apologize for any inconvenience caused and hope you can join us at any of our future events." A community day at a Fleetfield church was also cancelled. St Paul's Church, at the corner of Blandford Road and Hatfield Road, was due to throw open its doors on Saturday for a wide range of free, family-friendly attractions. The Courtyard Cafe in Hatfield Road has closed for 1 week in response to government guidelines, with a blackboard outside the cafe saying they will provide an update in a week's time. Meanwhile, local neighbourhood watch groups have been warning members about fraudsters using the spread of coronavirus to facilitate various types of fraud and cybercrime. These include fraudulent traders selling face masks and phishing emails from organisations claiming to be affiliated with the Centres for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the World Health Organization, WHO. They claim to be able to provide the recipient with a list of coronavirus-infected people in their area through links to malicious websites. Police community support officers have been instructed to cancel any non-urgent community events in an effort to help contain the spread of the virus. And the article's accompanied by a picture of, indeed, the blackboard outside the Courtyard Cafe in Hatfield Road, saying they'll be closed for a week.
Hello, this is Gilly, reading to you from home. The article I'm going to read you is about the women movers and shakers at the heart of our community. Five influential women involved in the district's business community and charity work talked about their successes and challenges at a packed event to mark International Women's Day. They included Emma Bustamante, owner of Casitas on Hollywell Hill, Ruby Rout, chief executive of Wooka, the period pants company, Alison Bainbridge, founder of St Albans-based market research business Kokoro, Laura Hussey, an environmentalist and human rights advocate, and Lisa Rayner, managing director of the European and Asia-Pacific arm of global branding agency Beanstalk. Local entrepreneur Emma Bustamante highlighted the large number of women in St Albans who own and run independent retail businesses on the high street. "It's incredible that St Albans is doing this," Emma told the audience. "What a great place to live, that we're able to accommodate all these skilled workers in small companies where large corporations have failed them. It shows that by supporting the high street, you're not just supporting local businesses, you're supporting women as well." Lisa Rayner spoke about achieving gender balance in the workplace. "You need to break the stereotypes of what a leader should be. It's perfectly okay for women to be vulnerable, collaborative, and empathetic. These are leadership qualities that are important today. They may once have been seen as stereotypes, as what holds women back, but these are exactly the qualities required in today's leaders. You need to have this emotional sensibility in order to be effective leaders." The annual event, held at Ye Olde Fighting Cox Public House in St Albans and hosted by St Albans MP Daisy Cooper, also marked the culmination of a campaigning week on gender inequality, which included meeting survivors of domestic abuse at St Albans and Harpenden Women's Refuge and speaking to staff and volunteers about their funding needs and the importance of their work for women in distress, tabling a bill in Parliament to bring an end to jail sentences for women who commit non-violent crimes but who suffer more wildly than male prisoners from alcohol and drugs and mental health problems, with self-harm rates five times higher. And also meeting WASPI women for the fourth time, locally, regionally and in Parliament, to support their campaign to win compensation for millions of women born in the 1950s, affected by poor implementation of changes to the state pension age. And there's a picture of all these ladies. Very nice too.
Athena Network. A number of St Albans and Redbourne businesses are moving their collaboration online in an effort to continue serving their customers and support each other during the uncertainty coronavirus brings. The Athena Network is a business networking and development club for female business owners and executives that's been running for 15 years and offers monthly daytime networking meetings, along with free training and business supporting for all its members. For business women in and around St Albans and Redbourne, next Wednesday sees the launch of two new networking groups from the Athena Network at a joint launch event which will now take place online. For freelancers and small business owners, it's a way of meeting other businesses, sharing contacts, and looking for potential alliances. And there's an accompanying picture of some members of the networking group around tables.
Attic find lights up St. Albans history. A chance find in a local attic has shed new light on the development of housing, shops and factories in St. Albans between the 1870s and the 1940s. The discovery of 300 architects' plans for key city locations in a Beckett's Avenue house is being considered a major find by the St. Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society, and it's called the Ark and Arc, which believes they will provide hitherto unknown details about these buildings. The plans have now been acquired by the Society, guaranteeing that they will be preserved and made available to local historians, researchers, and the relevant property owners. They include the Hosiery Mills in Fleetville, where Morrison's is now located, the Marks and Spencer's building, and Mallison House in St. Peter Street, and various domestic properties in the Fleetville area. Society President Sandy Walkington explains that such documents are rarely made available to the public to study. St. Albans District Council may have copies of these plans on microfilm, but their busy planning department is not set up to readily accommodate researchers. Once catalogued, this collection will be available to society members and public alike to access at our library at Sandridge Gate. I was intrigued to see how late stables continued to be seen as necessary and desirable facilities. But there is so much else which show how people's lives change over the period. Becky and Chris Shepherd discovered the drawings in their attic. They are delighted that they have found a suitable home where members of the public can use them. Becky said, "That was really important to us. We want people to see these plans. Some are beautiful objects in their own right. It's been great learning from members of the society what these drawings tell us about the city we so much enjoy living in." Founded in 1845, the Ark and Arc is celebrating its 175th anniversary this year. Sandy added, "Acquiring and preserving documents to ensure they will be available in another 170 years is one of our key objectives. This acquisition is further evidence of the key role that society continues to play in helping us all understand the history of this wonderful city." The catalogue, listing the 300 or so plans, will be posted on the Society's website, www.stalbanshistory.org, in the next few months. And there's a picture of the Society President Sandy Walkington inspecting the plans with Chris and Becky Shepherd from the Beckett's Avenue house and their son Alex.
Buy during a crisis, don't sell. Think carefully before pressing the sell button, says financial expert Peter Sharkey. This headline advice, probably contrary to anything you've read or heard recently, comes from David Drayman, a retired Canadian money manager and author of Contrarian Investment Strategies. In a chapter headed Crisis Investing, Mr. Drayman notes that the standard reaction to crises rarely changes. The advice given by experts over time has always been a knee-jerk recommendation to sell, he says. Economic history suggests we can expect financial markets to bounce back from the current crisis. Mr. Drayman provides numerous examples of how stock markets have recovered from seemingly desperate times, noting that within 12 months of four post-war crises, the Cuban Missile Crisis, JFK's assassination, the 1979 oil price crash, and the 1990 Gulf War, America's Dow Jones Index rose by an average of 27.5%. Closer to home, stock market recovery from the most recent major financial crisis in 2008 was equally impressive. At the depths of the doom and gloom in mid-October 2008, the FTSE 100 index plummeted to a low of 3,861. By the end of December 2009, however, it had risen 53% to 5,412. people investing in, say, a pension should remember that such investments are usually very long term, often upwards of 30 years. In between times, market crashes will invariably occur, usually as a result of political or, as is presently the case, a medical crisis. As a result, many people will panic and sell, but history shows us that the longer-term impact of these crises on a pension pot fades over time, a point worth remembering if you're contemplating pressing the sell button. Please note, with investing, your capital is at risk.
Hello again. This is a column by Daisy Cooper, our new MP. I believe she's going to be writing every week in the paper. And it starts, "Welcome to my Westminster Diary. Each week, I'll be giving a light-hearted behind-the-scenes take on what life is really like as a new MP. From jeering and bobbing, procedures and prayers, I'll be lifting the lid on the mother of all parliaments. Think the thick of it, not House of Cards. They say a week is a long time in politics, and this week, coronavirus was a case in point. Over the course of the week, I stopped shaking hands altogether. To start with, it felt rude and distant, turning down a handshake, but by the end of the week, people were apologising for even trying to reach for one. Initially, a few people wanted to bump elbows instead, until someone pointed out that if you don't have a tissue, you should cough and sneeze into the crook of your arm. In Parliament, the first MP was diagnosed. Those who had been in close contact or proximity to her were urged to self-isolate. Some MPs highlighted that many staff in Parliament don't know whether they would have been or not. Not every parliamentary researcher, intern, canteen worker or doorman will know who every MP is. To be honest, even I would struggle. My chief whip asked if I'd had any contact with her. Nope, I hadn't. Media outfits asked if I'd been at the number 10 event that she had attended. Nope, I hadn't. The new social shame of sneezing without a tissue or hand gel at the ready was a reality, as discovered by one guilty MP in the chamber who sat red-faced with all opposition eyes glaring at him. In the lift, a rather stoic-looking female MP asked what I made of the whole thing. It's always good to answer questions with a witticism in the lift, because you're only ever going up or down by a maximum 3 floors. I joked that I wished us MPs could legislate to force Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, to self-isolate. If we can keep him safe, we should be all right, I said. Very good, she replied, and we went our separate ways. As I write, the local elections have just been postponed for a year. By the time you read this, events will have changed further still. A week might be a long time in politics, but in St Albans, plans to help are popping up daily. Community groups, pubs, banks and volunteer networks stand ready to help anyone who might find themselves in need. And there's a picture with the article of the Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty.
Finally, an article titled MP Urges Community to Protect the Most Vulnerable. And this is from Bim Afolami, Hitchin and Harpenden MP, who has appealed to his constituents to come together as a community amid the coronavirus outbreak. Mr. Afolami addressed residents in his latest public newsletter on Tuesday morning, urging them to, quote, do all we can to protect the most vulnerable in society, our loved ones and ourselves. He said, Hitchin, Harpenden and the surrounding villages are places where people look out for one another. I've been heartened to see such extraordinary reserves of kindness and goodwill. Several individuals and local businesses have come forward to offer support to those who may need it. Each day, my team and I receive hundreds of emails from constituents. While my office will still answer as best we can, all priority will now be given to answering messages and helping residents with regards to the coronavirus. Mr. Afolami reiterated the importance of following preventative measures, including social distancing, protecting the vulnerable, and household isolation. He said, in a few days' time, those who fall into the vulnerable sector will be asked to shield themselves from social contact for around 12 weeks. You fall into this category if you are over the age of 70 or under the age of 70 but usually advised to have the flu vaccination each year, such as those with chronic heart, lung or kidney disease, and pregnant women. If anyone in the household has either or both of the two key symptoms, a high temperature or a new continuous cough, then everyone in the household must self-isolate for 14 days. This includes not going out other than for exercise, maintaining a safe distance from others, and this will mean relying on either relatives, friends, or our wonderful communities to help out where they can, fetching food or essentials and delivering them outside your doorstep. If you live by yourself and have either or both of those two key symptoms, you must self-isolate for 7 days. My Facebook, Twitter, and website will continue to provide regular updates and information that may be useful to residents, so please make sure to check these regularly over coming weeks and months. A look now at radio programmes broadcast from Monday to Friday in the week ahead.
Radio listings for Talking Newspaper, Saturday 21st to Friday 27th March. Now here is a selection of radio programmes for the coming week which we hope you might enjoy, starting with Saturday 21st March. And in Pam Eyre's Open Road, the writer visits St Austell in Cornwall at 2:15pm on Radio 4 Extra. Over on Radio 4, the afternoon drama is To the Ends of the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, an adaptation of Jules Verne's sci-fi novel about a scientist travels on the vessel of a renegade submariner who has turned his back on the human race. That's on Radio 4 at 3pm. At the same time on Classic FM is Moira Stewart's Hall of Fame concert, this week including works by Vaughan Williams, Bach, Bizet, Ravel, Elgar, Chopin, and Tchaikovsky at 3pm on Classic FM. Finally, for Saturday, the evening drama is Day Release by Peter Jukes, starring Lenny Henry as the lifer Frank Watt, as he prepares to face life on the outside after spending 30 years in prison. That's at 9pm on Radio 4.
Moving on to Sunday 22nd of March. For early risers in Something Understood, Just Listen, Mark Tully promotes the value of taking time to listen to what others have to say, a difficult but often greatly appreciated social skill. He also considers the way listening to radio can evoke mental pictures more easily than watching television. With music by Rossini, Stravinsky, Britten, and the Taizé monastic community, and featuring writing by Wallace Stevens, Rumi, and Sawley MacLean, Something Understood is at 6:05am on Radio 4. In the afternoon, in Open Book, Mariella Frostrup is joined by Patina Gappa, who talks about her novel Out of Darkness, Shining Light, a reimagining of an epic journey in 19th century Africa involving transporting the body of explorer and missionary David Livingstone. That's at 4pm on Radio 4. It's followed at 4:30pm on Radio 4 by Four Seasons, with poems for the spring equinox. For late night listening, Slow Radio, Rain on a Hot Tin Roof, brings together global archive sounds of rain on tin roofs. Whether an unrelenting downpour on an open porch in a nutmeg plantation in Indonesia, or a shanty boat in Tennessee under the full force of a lightning storm, you can hear that at 11:30pm on Radio 3.
We now turn to some programmes which are broadcast at the same time throughout the week from Monday to Friday. Starting with the Book of the Week, which this week is Dark Salt Clear, Life in a Cornish Fishing Village, in which L. Potter reads from Lamorna Ashe's book about travelling to the town of Newlyn, close to Land's End, to find out about its fishing community. Book of the Week is on Radio 4 every weekday at 9:45am and repeated at 12:30pm.
The composer of the week this week is again Beethoven, this week focusing on his life and career from 1796 to 1799, when he learnt to negotiate the privileged and moneyed circles of Vienna's culture-loving aristocracy to seek out wealthy patrons. That's at noon on Radio 3. At 12:04 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated at 10:45 p.m, the reading continues of The Mirror and the Light, the third part of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall trilogy. Radio 4 has a dramatization of Alexander McCall Smith's novel 44 Scotland Street, in which an anthropologist living in Edinburgh's New Town observes the daily business of her neighbours. That's at 7:45 p.m. each weekday. Finally, at 10:45 p.m. is the Essay Letters to Artists, Ian Sansom's series of imagined correspondences to some of history's greatest artists, including Albrecht Dürer, Picasso, and Caravaggio. That's at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 3.
Here are some individual programmes you can hear through the week. On Monday, 23rd March, The Battle for English investigates the global status of the English language, finding out why its preeminence may be coming to an end. That's at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. Stephen Sondheim in conversation with Mark Lawson, recorded at the 2010 Cheltenham Literary Festival, can be heard on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 p.m. The Full Works concert features works by musical prodigies including Barber, Mozart, Schumann, Bizet and Mendelssohn at 8 p.m. on Classic FM.
On Tuesday, 24th March, the afternoon drama is Playing Dead by Vivian Harvey. When her father's remains are found in a mass grave in Iraq, Mancunian Rosa Riley returns to the war-torn country she fled as a child. Her journey unearths the secrets of her past, and she makes a miraculous discovery. Playing Dead is at 2:15 on Radio 4. At 4 p.m, The Hidden History of the Mantelpiece sounds intriguing. Dr. Rachel Hurdley explores the role of the mantelpiece through the ages and questions if past generations may have had cause to fear somebody coming through the fireplace. That's on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. In the evening, Universal Basic Income, Lessons from Alaska, reports on how residents of Alaska receive an annual dividend from the state's permanent fund, which invests a big share of the profits of oil production for the benefits of all its citizens and has contributed to making it America's least unequal state. You can hear Universal Basic Income on Radio 4 at 8 p.m.
On Wednesday, the 25th of March, in the Extinction Tapes, the Yangtze River Dolphin on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m., Rob Newman tells the story of species we've lost forever and explores our role in their extinction. In The Price of Happiness, A Big White Wedding, Kate Fox turns to the topic of glamorous weddings and the secrets of a successful marriage. She got married in a lighthouse with guests waiting to cross the causeway because the lighthouse keeper drew up the wrong tide times. The wedding cost under £1,000 and guests brought their own food. You can hear The Price of Happiness at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. For evening listening, The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe over on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. is always entertaining. And finally, there's food for thought in Free Thinking when Anne McAvoy is joined by Kylie Murray in a discussion of the Declaration of Arbroath, confirming Scotland's independence and politics now. That's at 10 p.m. on Radio 3.
Now to Thursday, 26th March. Starting with the Lunatic Line at 1:30 on Radio 4 Extra and repeated at 8:30 p.m, it looks at the history of the 600-mile British-built railway track stretching from the Kenyan coast to Uganda, which became known as the Lunatic Line owing to its astronomical financial and human costs. In this week's Ramblings, Claire Balding walks across a section of the Malvern Hills with members of the Herefordshire Interfaith Group. In a world that feels increasingly divided, the group draws together Muslims, Quakers, Buddhists, Methodists, and more. It's a leisurely stroll, with many pauses to reflect and share readings on the theme of pilgrimage and nature. Ramblings is at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. The film programme is at 4 p.m., looking at the film Spartacus and the part it played in reflecting events in the movie industry of the time, blacklisting and the role of the ghostwriter. The stars include Kirk Douglas, who died last month, aged 103. That's at 4 p.m. on Radio 4.
And so to Friday the 27th of March, when you can hear The Science of Dad, in which doctor and new father Oscar Duke looks at the role played by fathers in children's behaviour, happiness and cognitive skills at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. In the five-minute programme The Listening Project, members of the public share conversations in a project to build a picture of what life is like today. Fee Glover presents at 4:55 p.m. on Radio 4. Enjoy your listening week.
This is an article from the March edition of Hertfordshire Life magazine. We're grateful to the publishers for allowing us to use this and other articles. It's called Scientific Maverick. From finding the gas responsible for ozone damage to exploration on Mars and the Gaia theory, Ledgeworth-born James Lovelock has been a key mind in environmental science for decades. At the age of 100, he's not slowing down. James Lovelock's career has been rich, varied and extraordinary. An author, a scientist and environmentalist, he sees himself primarily as an inventor. And rightly so, his early innovations were significant, including a device that led to the discovery of the hole in the ozone layer, and another used in NASA's first mission to Mars. But he's best known through his many books for his Gaia hypothesis, that the Earth should be considered as one living organism. His predictions about climate change and the future of our planet have drawn praise and cynicism in equal measure among environmentalists and scientists the world over. Now 100 years old and still working, it was his early years in the newly created Letchworth Garden City that put him on a path of discovery and investigation. James was born in the town in the summer of 1919 to parents he describes as staunch socialists. So staunch, his suffragette mother's political interests drew her to London, and James was raised by his grandparents until he was six. His memories of those early years remain sparklingly clear, he says. They include his grandparents' house on Icknield Way and the excitement he felt at seeing the Flying Scotsman arrive at Hitchin Station. He remembers playing on Norton Common and walking from Pubfree Letchworth to the Three Chimneys in Norton every Sunday with his grandfather. He recalls his memories of the Spirella building where most of his aunts worked and how pleased he was to see it still there during a visit to the town in the 1990s. It was a childhood spent among adults. From an early age, I was constantly surrounded by adults, he explains. I had very few friends of my own age and would listen in on conversations between adults who in turn treated me like an adult. Of his father's influence, he says, he was a highly intelligent man, although he couldn't read or write. For my fourth birthday, my father gave me a box full of odds and ends that I could join together. It was mostly electrical wires, bells and so on. And he said to me, "There you are, see what you can make of this." I then went around my family asking why two wires were needed to send electricity. Nobody had the answer, so I had to find out myself. And that was my first glimpse of science. James's official education, however, did not get off to a flying start. In fact, he describes it as disastrous. "I attended a school that was either in Icknield Way itself or somewhere close by," he says. "A foolish young schoolteacher came in and made a demonstration of all the poisonous plants you could find on Norton Common. I'm afraid my scientific background was already forming in my mind. When she went out of the room, I rushed up to the table, caught hold of some of the plants and tried them on the girls to see what would happen. Fortunately, somebody came in and caught me, so I was expelled from school." Now, things didn't improve after James moved to London to live with his parents. At a grammar school in Brixton, he says he refused to do homework because I could remember it almost identically. I thought, what the hell's the point of doing homework if I can remember it all? He admits, however, to being poor at arithmetic, which he failed in his O-level exams. In sharp contrast, algebra was a walk in the park. Calculus, he said, was a doddle. It was obvious. As for quantum theory, why worry? After leaving school, James was apprenticed to a photographic chemical manufacturer. He went on to study chemistry at the University of Manchester. And during the Second World War, he worked for the National Institute of Medical Research, and in the late 1940s received a PhD in medicine from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. In the mid-1950s, James created the Electronic Capture Detector, ECD, to detect atoms and molecules in gas. According to a 2019 Science Museum article, Something in the Air, James Lovelock and Atmospheric Pollution, the machine was, quote, at least 1,000 times more sensitive than any other detector in existence at the time. It was able to detect chemicals at concentrations as low as 1 part per trillion. That's equivalent to detecting a single drop of ink diluted in 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Using the ECD, James was the first to detect the widespread presence of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, in the air from solvents, fridges, air conditioning units and aerosol sprays. This led to further research and ultimately the discovery of the damage caused by CFCs to the ozone layer. The same Science Museum article underlines the importance of James's scientific contribution. Quote, his investigations with the ECD gave us the first indication that human pollution had spread across the globe and revolutionised our understanding of the atmosphere and our environment. In 1961, NASA recruited James to develop instruments for analysing planetary surfaces, and he was the first UK scientist to work on the Viking mission, NASA's first attempt to reach Mars. NASA needed a lightweight mechanism that could be mounted on a small spacecraft to measure chemicals on the surface of Mars and send the results back to Earth. The team would then determine if it was capable of supporting life. They had a series of meetings and all sorts of queer-looking separators were demonstrated, but none of them worked, he says. In fact, they were getting desperate, and I remember saying, do you have any palladium tubes? If you give me a bit, I could do some experiments. James persevered until he developed an effective way to take samples on Mars. The news was greeted by cheers from his NASA colleagues. It's fun, he says, to look out of this window on the right sort of night and see Mars in the sky and to know I've got two bits of hardware that worked for 3 months on Mars. In 1965, inspired by his time at NASA, James first thought of the Earth as a self-regulating system. The idea evolved in his mind, leading to the formulation of what is now known as Gaia theory, a model of the planet in which the living and non-living parts are viewed as a complex, interacting system that can be thought of as a single organism. In Greek mythology, Gaia is the primordial goddess who personifies the planet, a Mother Earth who gave life to everything and to whom all things return. And James has spoken about how the novelist William Golding, a close friend and neighbour, came up with the name. You'd better give it a proper name, Golding said. It's too big a theory to be some scientific acronym, so I suggest you call it Gaia. In a 2014 Naked Science interview about the hypothesis, James said, we now realise that the Earth does regulate itself, and we know quite a bit about all the various systems. You see, it's a good theory. It's made no less than 10 predictions that have come true, and that's good going for any theory. James talks with great urgency about the need for drastic action to halt the damage being done to the environment, although he fears it might now be too late. He's often been held up as a figurehead for the environmental movement, but this doesn't sit well with him. In his book The Revenge of Gaia, he talks about how the Green Movement ends up reflecting the demagoguery of the founders. People love movements, he says. They love to belong to something, get together and try to chat about it. But I've never been convinced they're deeply sincere about their attitude to the Green Movement. It's more a case of let's get together and try to do something about it, which is not the same thing. When it comes to environmental matters, he's clear. The problem is the large organisations, he says, government and commercial, that burn coal and oil for power. That's their way of making a living, and they're not going to give it up until the last moment. They'll do anything to resist any attempt to stop it. You only have to read the newspapers to see that some nations have discovered new oil fields, and this is treated as good luck for that nation. We should treat it as a disaster. In The Revenge of Gaia, James writes he's in favour of nuclear power because he believes renewables are not capable of generating the required energy. 14 years on from its publication, he's still pro-nuclear, despite renewables producing more than 33% of power in the UK in 2018. You can pretend the problem's being solved, he says, but we continue to burn oil and coal, and that's what's damaging the world. It's a great threat to us. It's reached a point of such desperation that most of the energy companies are beginning to realise the end is within sight, not because of the threat to the world, but because they won't have any money coming from it. It will die quietly, but we have to hope that it dies in time, because if it goes on burning carbon, we're doomed. There's not much doubt about that. On a brighter note, James has shown that change can be made by an individual through new practical ideas. All you need to do is patent your invention and they, the manufacturers, pay you a fee, he explains. If you have 5 going on at one time, this will pay for any research and equipment and income. It's a very practical way of doing science, and as far as I know, I'm the only one who does it. It's not difficult, and I've brought into this country 10 times more cash than I've taken from it. As the interview draws to a close, James says he's enjoyed sharing his childhood memories of Letchworth and his early scientific explorations. It seems a fitting time to ask one last question that he has a rare perspective on. At the age of 100, he's as fit as a flea and his mind is razor sharp. How does he do it? Well, as he prepares to head off for his daily walk along the Dorset coastline with his wife Sandy, he shares some excellent advice. Keep walking. That's the secret to longevity. And keep interested. This article was written by Johanna Flaherty, with special thanks to Kevin and Sarah Jones, who made the interview possible.
Now, before we go on to the next article, here is an interesting selection of people and events whose birthdays and anniversaries take place in the following few days. First of all, birthdays. On the 22nd, 1912, Irish actor Wilfred Bramble, who was part of Steptoe and Son, I'm sure you'll remember. 1923, French mime artist Marcel Marceau. And 1930, American lyricist Stephen Sondheim. On the 23rd, Joan Crawford in 1905, Akira Kurosawa, the famous Japanese film director of The Seventh Samurai. He was born in 1910. 1921, English land and water speed record breaker Donald Campbell. Sir Roger Bannister in 1929, the man who broke the 4-minute mile. And Barry Cryer, 1935, comedian and writer. On the 24th, in 1874, in Budapest, the famous escapologist Harry Houdini. In 1930, American heartthrob film star Steve McQueen was born. On the 25th, Bela Bartok in 1881, A.J.P. Taylor in 1906, and David Lean, the great British film director, 1908. And on the 26th, Tennessee Williams in 1911. Bill Edrich, the English cricketer, and Dennis Compton's batting partner, 1916, and Leonard Nimoy, a.k.a. Dr. Spock, in 1931. On the 27th, Henry Royce, Gloria Swanson, James Callaghan, and Michael York were all born on the 27th of March. And on the 28th, 1902, Dame Flora Robson, 1921, British actor and writer Dirk Bogarde. And finally, Sir Michael Parkinson in 1935. And this week also sees the following anniversaries in history. 1306, Robert the Bruce was crowned Robert the First, King of Scots, having killed his rival, John Comyn. In 1625, Charles the First, King of England, Scotland and Ireland, ascends the English throne. In 1807, the first fare-paying passenger railway service in the world was established on the Oystermouth Railway in Swansea. In 1934, driving tests were first introduced in Britain. 1939, the Spanish Civil War ended. And in 1957, All Shook Up by Elvis Presley was released and ushered in a whole new era of popular music. But then in 1963, another new era was the Beatles' release of their first album, Please Please Me. And now another article from Heart's Life about the largest printing operation on Earth, which is right here in Hertfordshire.
Presses that rolled under Fleet Street are silent, replaced by the likes of Broxbourne's mega news printing site, the biggest in the world. We go inside to see the nightly miracle. The words are by Louise McAvoy, photos by Newsprinters. Now that's the company that we refer to several times in the article. It's a little known fact that Broxbourne is home to the largest newspaper printing plant in the world, where the majority of the UK's national newspapers are printed. The sprawling 40-acre site is part of a £650 million investment which saw the company Newsprinters establish 19 presses at three UK plants, 12 in Broxbourne, 5 in Liverpool's Knowsley, and 2 in Glasgow. Situated just off the A10 and a stone's throw from the M25, planning permission for the Broxbourne plant was granted in 2005. It took 2 years to build, going into full production in May 2008. Now 3.35 million daily newspapers are printed at the site every weekday, and that's not to mention weekend papers, supplements and weekly titles. All three sites are highly automated using state-of-the-art technology, and while the Broxbourne site has more than 350 employees, only a handful of skilled custodians are required to keep a watchful eye on the machinery should anything go awry. There are machines for pretty much everything. Every day there are 50 deliveries of blank paper shipped from all over the world, offering different grades and reel sizes, and from the moment the reels arrive, nobody touches them. Floor-level conveyor tracks move the huge reels, which can measure up to 2.21 metres in diameter and weigh up to 2 tonnes, effortlessly to the storage area, before preparation machines unwrap their protective layer prior to the printing process. This uses plates to transfer the layout of digitally designed pages to the paper on vast machines. The whole process is one of rolling movement. Once the newspapers have been printed, they're sorted into bundles, stacked on pallets and wrapped in cling film, again all by machine. Commercial director Tracy Hart says, because it's automated, if it runs well, there's nothing much for the team to do apart from check the density of the ink and observe. And even when things go wrong, they're very calm. Everything is timed to the minute, so any delay, however short, can have far-reaching consequences. Tracy Hart again. We contract every title to a time they must submit all their files, but the flow of files is really important because we need to create the plates for printing. What we want to avoid is file bunching when we receive 52 pages in the last 3 minutes, for instance, because then it's a horrific task. It's not like producing a tin of beans. We create a brand new product every day, and some editors sign off on pages at the last minute, but we still have to meet certain deadlines to get the newspapers to the retailers on time. She adds that things happen that the team can't account for. It's very much reactive and last minute. That's our world. We do have a really energised team who are very engaged because they know any slip of concentration is so impactful. The staff are passionate about what they do, and it's great to work in this print world and to be a part of it. And when that story breaks or when a problem happens, that's the excitement. The night of a general election is always a big buzz, and I remember the atmosphere when the story on Michael Jackson's death broke, as well as the Telegraph's exclusive on the MP's expenses scandal. Today we don't know what tomorrow's front page is going to be and what will drive the news or delay the news. The tight deadlines, which leave very little room for error, have to be met 364 days of the year, pausing only for Christmas Eve, and staff refer to the challenge as, quotes, the nightly miracle. It's essential any problems are dealt with deftly because thousands of copies of newspapers are printed every minute. Newsprinters' customers get a minute-by-minute report, some with live access, and every morning an internal meeting is held to scrutinise the previous night's performance. Business Improvement Director Richard Johnson explains, "We get feedback on performance that the daytime staff analyse, so we're learning and improving day by day. Now, with machines, anything can happen, and the night shift have to mitigate the impact of that. It's amazing how quickly the team can fix a problem with the presses, pulling out any debris and refeeding the paper. But while time is of the essence, it's a balancing act between speed and accuracy. And Richard said, if you rush putting the plates on the press, you could damage the plates or break the web, that's the paper. While the system is highly automated, skilled printers are essential for the operation to continually succeed. But a significant shift in emphasis from print to digital means printing is a dying art form and recruiting skilled staff is becoming increasingly difficult. We have an ageing workforce, says Tracy, and a lack of a pool to go to for trained printers. Young people are not interested, so to find a trained printer is quite hard. The company, Newsprinters, offers an apprenticeship scheme, hoping to entice youngsters into the industry and develop their skills in-house. But revival of interest on a wider scale would be preferential, Tracy admits. The industry has seen declining print sales in the years since the Broxbourne plant was built, due to the explosion of digital news sources. But in that time, Newsprinters' customer base has actually grown, due to the unfortunate demise of smaller printing plants around the country. It also offers an end-to-end service, from printing to distribution, seizing every opportunity to maximise its service. We want to ensure we optimise everything we do and use from ink to paper, Tracy insists. Even the biggest newspaper printing plant in the world is not without its problems. The Broxbourne site was built at the height of newspaper print sales, explains Tracy. It was built for volume at speed with triple-width presses instead of the standard double-width, so we can print a lot faster for the high pagination titles. What we're not so good at is varying trim sizes or inserting supplements and leaflets, and customers want special bespoke things now, and that's been a challenge for us. Another challenge for newsprinters, and one Tracy says is being addressed, is finding ways to reduce its carbon emissions, minimise waste, and increase its green credentials. She says a lot of work has been done to avoid the need to use a chemical solution to clean the blankets which go between the rollers to help ensure pressure is distributed evenly across the plates. We have to ensure we print the best quality we can, but we've now produced a water wash because we want to be kind to the environment. We've also substituted plastic poly bags with ones made from potato starch, and unsold newspapers are brought back and recycled. We also use aluminium cores for our paper reels, so when a reel ends, the core goes back to the paper mill and is reloaded. Ultimately, we can't change the fact we use paper, but we must do as much as we can for the environment. This Hertfordshire printing plant, colossal in its size and capability, and adapting to changing demands from clients, is still for now at the heart of the UK newspaper industry. When we open up tomorrow's newspaper, perhaps you should consider the nightly miracle that took place to make it. And there are some numbers, some very large numbers, about this print site. The size of the Broxbourne site in acres is 40. The initial build cost was 187 million, and a further 161 million was invested in equipment, including those triple-width presses, which can print up to 86,120-page full-colour newspapers every hour. 3,350,000 copies of daily newspapers are printed per day, and 3,780,000 weekend newspapers are printed each week, plus supplements. 900 million newspapers are printed each year, creating 300,000 tonnes of newsprint. Titles include The Sun, The Times, The Telegraph, The Daily Mail, The London Evening Standard, Metro and The Financial Times. 1.1 million full-colour, 120-page newspapers can be printed every hour. 3,860,000 rolls of blank paper, measuring up to 2.21 metres in diameter and weighing up to 2 tonnes, can be stored at any one time. And 180 reels per hour are handled by 6 reel preparation machines.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. I do hope you'll all keep listening in the coming weeks with the new arrangements outlined by Rob at the beginning of this programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Jilly, Ian, Jenny and Bob. And as ever, thank you for listening. Rob will be producing next week's News Extra programme, but that's all from me, Bill Redway, in March 2020. We close with Joy by the AKA Trio. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye and stay safe.